I'm your host, Sully, and I don't think I have my pants down, but then again, I think I've gone blind. So our co-anchor here tonight on ABC is JJ Bruno, not Abrams.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
50-foot gorilla town breaches downtown New York. Women and minorities most affected. Film at 11.
Film at 11.
Film at 11.
And Tom, not the wise ass, Lindemann is also in the house.
Yep. This is Tom Brokaw.
Tom Brokaw. Oh, you see.
Yeah. LA,
so we're driving down is... Highway 40 in my big old pickup truck.
This was a begging by Tom. He's like, how about we're talking about all the various creators and animators. How about we go into the producers known as Jerry and Sylvia, not the mole people on Mystery Science Theater, just Jerry and Sylvia Anderson.
Yes.
And I was all for it. I was like, okay, you know, because these are guys who, much like any kind of TV producer, whether it's Stephen J. Cannell or Stephen Botchko or Hanna-Barbera, and anyone has seen them in some capacity somewhere somehow, and if not, then they're probably a fan of some other TV show or animation that is heavily inspired by their production. So
exactly,
for those not in the know or who are in the know but just want a simple summary, again, Jerry and Sylvia Anderson, they have both left us, but they have they were a husband and wife duo, British TV producers. They assembled the Supermaria Nation, as it was called, shows that were Supercar, Stingray, Thunderbirds, and Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, and as well as the live action sci-fi epics UFO and Space 1999. They later made various TV movies and compilation movies of Thunderbirds and Space 1999. And since then, they've just have just often been referenced in a lot of just Saturday morning programming. what was your introduction into them, Tom, since you brought up this?
I was younger than 10 when I first saw my first episode of Space 1999, and I was hooked. They had the little disc shooter with the little guns they used, and I got one of those. I was mesmerized by the colors, by the action, and granted, I was probably coming in on season two instead of season one, but it was still science fiction, and I was and still am a science geek. So I absolutely loved it. Then as I got older, I ran into, they used to run a show called Terrahawks, which was also done by Jerry and Sylvia. It was similar to the Supermaria Nation, but they were actually using more puppets. And my parents hated that show, but it was one of those that caught me the right way. It's like,
my uncle was a huge fan, but he liked anything with puppets, and I was partial to puppets. And I'm with you. I would see a lot of reruns of it on TV Land and the like, just throughout the years. I never followed as much as, you know, Three Stooges and Looney Tunes or anything, but it was a similar kind of, it's like, hey, you know, there's a reason this is a Saturday morning cartoon and it has been referenced endlessly. And I shouldn't call it a cartoon. It's technically, you know, marionette, you know, show, but it was still a special kind of, hey, you know, here's how you utilize any kind of story. It doesn't have to be just, you know, this format or that format. This is technically what would be a cartoon or maybe a small, low budget, you know, Saturday show with maybe a, you know, soap opera type. story and limited visual quality, but there's a reason it made an impact. And unfortunately, I think I mentioned Thunderbirds. I think some people just remember that infamous 2004 Spy Kids knockoff movie that put Jonathan Franks in director jail.
I'll never forget.
I think it was the Dallas Morning News that said, "Sometimes I just want kids to die on film, and this is one movie." I thought it was a Roger Ebert review, but he did not say that. He was not a fan, long story short, of any kind of Thunderbirds programming. He was like, he called it gobbledygook. And this is gobbledygook the movie now.
No, I'll have to admit, I am a fan of that, of the Thunderbirds movie that Frakes did.
No, it's fine. It's got decent visuals. It's just one of those. I mean, it's way better than the Lost in Space movie. I'll give it that.
Yeah, but I will say that as a fan of, as a casual fan of the original show, and watching the movie, the spirit is still there. It's a lot like the Speed Racer movie.
That's a good contrast.
The visuals were a little bit off kilter as compared to the original, but the spirit was there, and that's where the fun is.
Yeah,
fair enough. but JJ, you mentioned, and you have mentioned UFO and Space 1999, and you know we brought him up. Ironically, several times before, how you see their blood and DNA and just a lot of other just experimental sci-fi anthologies. And
yeah,
it's a shame that much like 1999, it was treated much like Buck Rogers. We wanted to be like the popular show Star Trek, which is ironic because Star Trek didn't start out popular like we know it to be now.
Well, what it was that with me, like with Tom, I got to see Thunder, I got to see Space 1999 as a kid. And I think I had the Eagle One toy that had Professor Bergman and Helena Richardson and Captain Commander Koenig.
I had the toy. Kenner who made any?
It was either Mattel or Remco. I forget who did it. I had the toy.
It was Mattel.
It was okay. It was. I think it was Mattel. And they had the figures, the action figures. I didn't have the action figures though. Those are real rare to get now. They did a reprint of them. Like Mego was doing them for a while.
Yeah.
And I think Morty Abrams, who runs Mego, is like putting them back out again. But what I remember is, I do remember Thunderbirds when I was a kid, because they played it on, one of the local stations here would play it Saturday mornings. Yeah. And then they did the movies. Cause if you remember, they did Thunderbirds Argo.
Yep. Yes.
And they had the great thing about one. And then they did another movie after that with the Thunderbirds. And one of them was, they had Cliff Richard Jr. and the Sons of the Shadows. And if anybody knows British pop music, Cliff Richard and the Shadows were the big band back in the '60s. You know, they were like kind of like before the Beatles hit. Yes. So they had like a super marionette version of it. I don't remember UFO that much because it probably didn't hit. You know, you got to think it's Lou Grade.
ITV, I think it was late at night. Would probably, much like Red Dwarf, it would probably be a local PBS or antenna station.
Yeah, if you were lucky.
No, it was on like PIX, which was like Channel 11 here.
Oh, okay.
So because what happened was ITV, Lou Grade's, Sir Lou Grade, who was a big television guy back in England, would sell these shows to like independent stations, like let's say a TBS or a WPIX. Or, WNYW, which was Channel 5 out here, which is now Fox.
Oh, wow.
He would sell them. And they would get, like, this reputation of, you know, people would watch. I was watching The Avengers and, you know.
The 60s shows. The Saint
when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So Space 1999, I do remember being on that first run, but it was like a delayed thing over here. Because I think they first played in England, and then they came here to the United States, and I remember that happening when I was a kid, and watching like a couple of episodes, and being very amazed by it because the first season, I do remember the first episode where, well, let me just say, Thunderbirds is a great series, first off, by itself, because International Rescue, you know, they have the sons named after the Mercury astronauts.
It's easy to follow. You like the design, to follow, art direction,
you know, and the special effects were like, for a kid, you know, you're watching, you know, hey, what's going on here? You know, it's all,
yeah,
it's all these, you know, it's like, you know, they have like, you know, the characters of the, like, you know,
much like Super Friends or even Mission Impossible, you're accepting this whole secret agency that keeps the country safe, you know.
Yeah. And the thing was that there's one guy on that show, I have been and was a big fan of, a guy named Shane Rimmer. He was the secret weapon for Jerry and Sylvia Anderson, because he played one of the voices. I think he played Scott Tracy, one of the kids. And, you know, he was the voice of the marionette. And then he did an episode of UFO, and then he did an episode of, he did a couple episodes of Space 1999. And the thing with UFO was, you know, there's a UFO invasion, and, you know, there's this film studio, and Ed Bishop, who played the head commander with that bad blonde toupee, you know, I thought he was an actual super marionette that came to life, because he had that really bad blonde toupee on. And, you know, Gabby Drake.
You always love to do that. Swing.
Puberty hits when you're watching UFO. You're like, oh my god, I like girls with purple hair. But
you know, it's a thing, guys.
But like the thing I loved about it was, okay, they were using some of the models for UFO. You know, it was just a really good idea. And then Space 1999 was built over an environmental disaster, which was smart. What if we took all the toxic waste and stuff and kept it on the moon in this dump, and the dump turned radioactive, and then the moon gets blasted out of orbit? Very heady first, and now these people have to cope with being on a planet that is basically now out of, what, you know, is out of the solar system. And they go on these adventures. And that was a great thing. That was the great thing about that show.
And it had the first reasonable production value. You know, they're filming it at Pinewood.
They were filming it at Pinewood. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Go ahead, Tom.
And not to mention, but UFO was a genesis of Space 1999.
Yeah.
Because they had a moon base.
And it's kind of cool that
Alpha.
Well, and we were still, you look at the uniforms, and clearly, you know, they got every kind of design, you know, Lost in Space, 2001. Mm-hmm. And it's cool how, I mean, it's just the natural progression of sci-fi. You take what you're currently seeing, and then you go your own formula with it. And to have it be kind of a spy agency, you know, in space, you know, is pretty cool.
Yeah. And I haven't watched all the episodes, but the episodes I have seen, or at least seen clips of,
still on Roku,
they deal with some really heavy stuff.
Yeah.
It's not kiddie sci-fi. It's not a guy in a rubber suit. It's some serious, serious shit.
Yeah, I mean, there's some episodes where it's like,
they made a damn big mistake.
Well, it's the things have to, it has to deal with, basically the whole thing of Space 1999 is isolation. You know, there's only like, what, 200 and some odd people on that base, and they can't procreate, they can't do anything. You know, it has to stay that status quo, and you're going through the universe, and God forbid, you know, you take one of those ships out, and you know, you can't come back to the base because you're lost. I mean, that's really some heady stuff, you know.
Yeah, years before we were doing the whole alien thing where you wake up after you've been like in a standstill you know, like little pod until, you know, it, the computer programs it, you know, to have you slide out and, you know, voila, you're awake. You can now, you know, you can now pee, you can now go on about and stretch. And
yeah, there was a really good episode in the first season of Space 1999 where they find a habitable planet that they could lay down on and they could set up camp on. But eventually it turns out that they can't.
Yeah.
And just that one episode goes from they found their haven, everybody's happy, then all of a sudden they realize they can't stay. Mm-hmm. And it's killing them, so they have to leave, even though it would be perfect for them. And it's...
The cake is a lie. It's too good to be true.
Exactly. And that's a lot of stuff with UFO, especially, that deals a little bit with isolation, but it also deals with the horrors of war. It, Ed Straker, the guy who commands Shadow, he lost a sister, you know, in all the alien invasions and stuff like that. And
all the stuff that was easier to talk about. And now if you were to do it, the people would either want to go a little too morbid or it just would be grim and probably not even fun to watch. But it is interesting how they're experimenting it with it here. Yeah. In the late 60s.
Yeah.
And they're just.
Yeah. And the thing was that. Remember there was an episode Ed Straker had to get this medicine to some young kid.
I think so.
Yeah. And I keep hearing about this episode, like he had to make a decision about, you know, the kid is either going to die or live or something, and something happens and the kid dies because he couldn't get the medicine in time to him. I just keep remembering hearing about this episode, but that was dealing with choices. A lot of it was choice.
Right. And it just naturally builds up tension instead of, and now we have to do this and now we have to do that. It's like, no, we got 40 minutes. We can kind of dive into this slowly, you know, and just kind of let it just stand until eventually, you know, come Poseidon Adventure, it's going to sink and we got to go now.
Yeah. That's one thing I will say over the, especially with the live action work they did, everything was really self-contained, but yet it had a lot of meat to it, whether it was the 23-minute show or whether it was the 44-minute show or whatever. They packed in as much as they could.
Yeah.
Linnea Larson was going for a theatrical feel, and they were kind of just going for, hey, you know, it's TV, but, you know.
Let's make a good TV.
Yeah, let's just worry about the plots, and it's got to be they were kind of just more about, let's go for just... escapism, and it can just slowly, you know, just kind of have a little, not serialized per se, but just a little bit of an intense and involving story here and there.
And a lot of philosophical stuff too. That philosophical first season of Space 1999, because you've got Barry Morse, who played Victor Bergman, and great actor, and he's like the thing with that first season is he's more the voice of reason in that.
He really is.
With you know, Martin Landau and what's her face?
Barbara Bain.
Barbara Bain, yeah.
The actress he was married to in real life. Yep.
Yeah, and he's more the voice, he's more like the Spock character.
Yes.
And he's like, if we do this, this may happen. And then, you know, Koenig has to make the decision. Well, we may have to do this. And she's like, but what if this happens? Then there's gotta be, you know, it was a product of the time of not, you know, they weren't trying to build like Star Trek, but in a way they were becoming more like, you know, the first season is more like, you know, the second season gets to be like Star Trek, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that becomes more like rubber suit man of the week kind of thing, you know, monster of the week. And they got rid of Barry Morris because he didn't want to do it anymore. And I think he left over a contract. And they replaced a lot of the actors Mm-hmm. And they brought in Catherine Schell to be the changeling. Yes. Maya. Yeah. Which I thought was a great idea, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, I concur. It was, like you say, it was kind of its own formula. And there's been some great books released about it recently, including they're very expensive. So, you know, unless you got $30 to $40 to shell out, you know, might wait for it to drop down in price. But I do applaud them because, like, they really went to town, like interviewing some of the production designers and other mm-hmm. less talked about mm-hmm. people, as well as unmade episodes, what the third envisioned season would have looked like.
Yeah, and I will, this is a hill I will willing to die on. I don't think too many people are going to challenge me on it, but the first season of Space 1999 is the most brilliant science fiction, or at least some of the most brilliant science fiction ever made.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it comes down not to the science fiction, not to the effects, but to the philosophical question, like JJ said, the moral questions, the human interaction. One thing that I picked up on very early when I started watching Space 1999 was how they use each other's first names most of the time.
Yeah.
So it was like Tony or Sue or whoever. And that created a vastly different feel than Star Trek. It made them seem closer, like a family.
Yeah, that's one thing I noticed too, Tom. They don't go commander or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like, I remember I'm watching it at one point, and like, you know, Koenig, what was Koenig's first name on that show? John. Yes. They've just blasted out of orbit, and he turns to Victor and says, Victor, you know, the Baron Moisture is like, Victor, what's going on? He's like, Victor's like, oh, we just, you know, the G forces have, you know, put us down. And he's like, oh, wow, you know, like, but you know, remember, this show was based on as I said, an environmental disaster that could happen. And the backstory of the first episode is they're trying to get to a planet called Meta.
Mm-hmm.
And Meta is the most habitable planet, and they're trying to do a space shot to it. And Koenig is the guy who's going to be like, I think Moonbase Alpha is going to serve as the launch pad for the Meta mission.
Yeah.
And he says, we can't do anything because we're losing men left and right with this whole disease that they have, where they just basically lose their brains, get scrambled.
Yeah, they can't even remember decipher that. How they got here, but it's now a mind fog.
No, it's what they're doing is they're moving the stuff. They're moving the. If you watch the episode, and Tom, okay. Tom, Tom, is yep. is remember we'll remember this clearly. They're going in. They're in the Eagles, which are those things that they were flying around in, right?
Yeah,
and they keep or not the Eagles. What is it? They're like in like a go-kart, like a moon go-kart almost, right?
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win Show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan, we're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
We're on all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
Yes.
And they're moving the stuff parts, around. Yes. And all of a sudden, they start hearing this high-pitched sound in their helmets. And they're like, Victor Bergman's going, like, get him here right away. And they look, and you see he has no eyeballs. Like, his eyes are whited out.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like his brain, everything that he would interact has been sucked out.
Yeah. And what they find out is that the magnetic waves are affecting the men because the toxin, the nuclear waste is acting with the magnetism that affects the brain in some way. And it's like, okay, you can go into all this heavy duty medical stuff and say, but it's affecting, hey, toxic waste affects people's health. You can get sick off it. This is something they're saying, this is what the message is, And the way it all happens, you're like, holy shit, it's just, you can't believe it, but the episodes, the first season is great, great writing, great, great production too. The second season, Fred Freeberger takes over.
No.
And
what was he infamous for other than
Star Trek? The third season of Star Trek.
Okay. Well,
he's the guy that took over that third season and basically said, he took over, for, I think, for Gene Koontz. And he basically told them, slash the budget. Don't do anything too expensive. Keep the story simple.
I actually don't mind the third season, but I think after that, after Space, I think he did become, I'm looking at it now, I think he did, and he was also involved with the final season of $6 Million Man, and
yeah,
he became the canceler guy.
Yeah. He says, if we're not doing well after this season, that's it, we're done. That's how he was. And he's viewed by a lot of science fiction fans as the guy who's killed a lot of series.
Yeah, I think he did some other stuff. I'm looking it up.
He was basically the Generalissimo of
just the bureaucrat kind of.
Yeah, yeah. He was a numbers guy.
He was briefly involved with Superboy, and pretty much became the for hire guy. He would write select episodes of Vegas, Dukes of Hazzard, and even the new Mike Hammer. So.
Yeah.
Interesting. But
he was very known as the guy who was like, don't make it too smart for people.
Slash,
you're going to lose them. You're going to lose them. Get them,
It's a shame because I like some of the Westerns he's worked on, but I guess he just wasn't ready for the challenge, I guess. Or
he was Ted McGinley before Ted McGinley was a thing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
He was take that back about Ted McGinley, because Ted McGinley did save Married with Children. I will say that. Let's give Ted McGinley credit where credit is due. Fred Freeberger was the anti version of Fred Silverman.
Oh shit!
Okay, it's like you have the matter and the antimatter. Fred Silverman and Fred Freeberger. I'm saying his name right. Fred Silverman goes to three networks and is like the Wonder Boy, right?
Right. All in the Family, Roots, Shogun. He wants
he greenlights everything. This will work. Fred Freeberger, he'll see a series and be like, dumb it down. We're losing viewers.
Just don't think about it too much.
If we don't see numbers by the end of the season, it's done. And that's what killed Space 1999, you know. I can't say Space right, I say Space.
Space.
Space 1999.
Space, baby.
But I gotta say this though, like the marketing for those shows, and Tom brought it up, you know, the Space 1999 gun. I remember that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember the toys. I remember, and there were toys for UFO too.
Yes, there were.
There was not Ertl, not Match. It was one of the British companies.
Corgi.
Put them out. They had Ed Stryker's car, and then they had the spaceship that there was. That Shadow used to fly in space. Mm-hmm. And then the Interceptor. And then they had the tank. The tank, yes. and something else. They never made Sid, though. They never made Sid, which was the satellite thing up in space.
That would have been cool.
Yeah. But Matchbox in the 80s put out the Thunderbirds line.
Yes.
And I had the big blue one that had the central compartment that came down, and the little yellow Thunderbird, the underwater thing came out. I remember I bought that. I bought that at a.
How much do you think they'd go for nowadays?
Oh, lots of money. Lots of money.
Yeah. At least $3.50.
Yeah, at least $3.55.
It's got to go.
Then you get the concert coming around.
I'll just say $300,000. Because I feel like.
But I mean, you know, the way they would the marketing was there so good, and you got to think too, the Super Mario Nation stuff was just so like ahead of its time.
Exactly.
I mean. Because this was all automated. This wasn't like, you know, a bunch of people, you know, like, you know, making the stuff move with, like, you know, they were building these little gear stuff, and, you know, and they would like wink their eyes or they would clap their hands. It was like
motion activated almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, ahead of its time.
Yeah, the thing was the technology was kind of there, but wasn't real being applied in the particular vein. So they were innovating. They had to innovate on the fly to create what we saw. And it turned out, even if it's dated, it by today's standards, it still turned out extremely well. And you could even see homages to it, like in Team America World Police.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Somebody had to bring it up.
The R-rated version.
Didn't they get in trouble for that? Like, didn't he come after them?
You're asking the wrong people to be, you know, to give a shit about who they offend. I mean, Trey Parker and Matt Stone are all about, hey, you know.
But there was another thing called Super Adventure Team.
Yes.
Super Adventure. Okay. Well, let's
It's like Nick. It wasn't like little shorts like in Nick at Night or something like that.
No. Super Adventure Team was.
I see it now. Okay. Wow.
Was on 1998, and it was using puppetry.
It was on MTV in 90.
It was on MTV. And it was marionettes, and it was done by Rob Cohen and Dana Gould.
Yep. Yeah, Robert had done everything from The Wonder Years and The Simpsons, and Dana Gould, we all know him from just his various stand-up and various writing on everything, you know?
It was only on for, like, one season, and all I remember is it was just fun to watch. Like, one time they have to do it where they're going to kill like the president of the United States, a bunch of terrorists. And the only thing they can do is play Rock and Roll All Night by Kiss. And it was like, I was hearing this. I was like, oh my God, I was laughing hysterical. They're like, Rock and Roll All Night, Rock and Roll. We've played Rock and Roll All Night. I know, we're going to do it again and again and again and again, you know. But yeah,
this episode's on YouTube. I think we got to talk about this.
Oh gosh, I remember that.
Yeah, back when MTV was pretty much whatever wasn't on Adult Swim, that's where it goes. Before they then felt, oh, and now we got to have reality TV and other dog shit.
I think that was the last.
Probably, definitely. Yeah,
that was the last like breath before it went downhill.
Have you guys seen America, the motion picture?
Yes.
I think JJ, you would dig it because like Team America, it's like they pretty much just make fun of just a distorted thing. Like we're all various presidents who aren't even in the same timeline must avenge each other. And the British have like giant Star Wars type Imperial walkers and giant robots like the Terminator. And it just basically like all the founding fathers have to become like this giant like X-Men Team America type.
Yep. It's America the movie is to America what Weird was to documentaries.
Okay. There you go.
All right.
Now, on a side note, you can find a lot of stuff on YouTube about the Anderson collaborations or the different shows.
There were so many good documentaries back when people wanted to actually know what went into your small screen TV. How was it created? What electricity was used to power it? Even go inside the writer's room and have some. The bumpers were just comedy gold.
There's a great documentary on, last I saw it was on Amazon Prime, specifically about Thunderbirds and about the about how they kind of got from where they started, which was a really early prototype of a kid show, to where they came to, where they actually did the movies and all of that. It goes into a little bit more later, but most of the chunk of it is based on Thunderbirds, and I highly recommend it. I wish I could remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it is very good. And I will also highly recommend, there are a couple other, one was a short movie that was, I think it was a pilot, it was trying to be a pilot to a kid show. It was involved one of the guys, actually one of the actors from Space 1999. It was called, let's see, what was it called? The Day After Tomorrow.
Why do I remember
it? It had a similar vein to Space 1999, where you had people who were lost in space. And it involved one of my favorite actors, because it's just over the top, is Brian Blessed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, man. He had one of my favorite lines from Space 1999, too. That's no moon. It's the Earth moon.
Wait, which episode? The one where they're like, it's him and the other guy, and they're like talking to this. Or was it the one where he's Maya's father? Because they did double roles.
Yeah, I think so. This is one where he was. It was his first season, and if I remember correctly, he was sort of like a Viking, or they were underground. It was really cold.
Yes. Yeah. I remember, and somebody gets sick, and they have to make penicillin, and Helena gets sick. And John has to make penicillin for her out of moss because they're trapped in another time. There was one where they did like a timeline, like they get stuck in one timeline, but there's another timeline. They had so many good actors on that show too.
Yeah, they did. Christopher Lee was in an episode.
Keep thinking Peter Cushing was in
it. It almost sounds like the time tunnel kind of.
Yeah, people back then, people wanted to be on that show, you know. It's like Batman. Mm-hmm. You know, but I remember Freddie Francis being on one. The guy from Crawl, the old guy from Crawl, remember him?
Yes.
Oh, okay. You
must get those for the Widow of the Web. Yeah. He was on that show where it was the future and they returned back to Earth, and they were just passing it, like they time traveled.
Yeah,
and they were just getting back to Earth for some strange reason. I keep remembering that.
Yeah, it's like they showed up a few days before the events of Breakaway.
Yeah, and they're trying to stop it, and they can't.
And
I gotta watch it again. I gotta watch the series again because I know it's on Roku. But
I'm also gonna recommend another one. This is not science fiction, but it's one that I would say that fell through the cracks, but is so good. It's one called The Protectors.
The Protectors.
It's Robert Vaughn and the guy who played Tony from the second series of second season of Tony. Space 1999, and one of the person who it's kind of loose how they
This was also a Gerry Anderson production.
Okay. Yeah, it was Nyrene Dawn Porter.
And it was they're sort of like an international group of people who protect other people or do different things. It's sort of spy, sort of protection, sort of.
They're basically U.S. Marshals. It's kind of hard to really explain
because it's not all set in stone. One of the things that always bugged me about it was that there was a lack of continuity. There's a lack of understanding of the bigger role. Everything was centered around Europe. But if you get past that, it's some good, solid work. With the exception of one episode, which was oddly enough, I think it was directed by Robert Vaughn. It was one where he tried to do comedy.
Not as fortunate.
And this was pre basketball, so he couldn't pull it off.
He wasn't a comic actor until I saw him in Joe's Apartment. but yeah,
why you saying that because
he wasn't Joe's Apartment. Funny. Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, I remember The Protectors because I had a whole I gotta go through this again because ITV Lou Grade like basically just shoved off a lot of stuff to the States, and you know the whole Gerry and Sylvia Anderson thing was part of that.
Yes,
because that's how we got Fireball XL and Joe 90 and Captain Scarlet and Supercar and what was the other
Stingray?
Stingray, Thunderbird.
Stingray, yep.
And this was all stuff that was kind of like pushed onto kids from the 60s and kids from the 70s, after school stuff. And then we got Space 1999 and we got UFO. And it's kind of sad because Gerry Anderson and Sylvia Anderson, after that, they kind of like disappear.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
They weren't interviewed all that much. I think they sold a lot of
pop up every so often, but not.
Yeah,
I want to say the thing that really kind of pushed them out was Terrahawks.
Yeah,
that it was a great concept. The puppets didn't look great.
No,
so that really hurt them. But they did eventually come back and start doing some other shows. It took them a while, but they did eventually come back. And
I never heard anything bad about their personas or anything.
No.
I guess it was just the budget was tight.
Although they did, they did break up over something. I don't know what. I think he just had enough of the BS. And
maybe he started dating Yoko.
Yeah, that's what I think happened. But she was actually the voice of Lady Penelope.
Yes.
Wow. On Thunderbirds. She was like, well, we got this actually. She said, I could do the voice because she could do it and she did it well,
It saved money because it's just me in the booth.
But what gets me is there's a video of Ed Bishop from UFO, and I think it was done maybe about 6 months to a year before he died. And they brought the wig out that he wore, and he sounds like he's drunk. He's like, you know how much I hated this freaking wig.
I think a lot of them were, professional or not, because
if you watch the show, it looks like he just has this wig on his head, and they were just like, hey, we'll get a Beatle wig, we'll get a wig that makes him look like David McCallum, but we'll just cut it. And it looked, he's like, I can't believe you found this thing. I thought this thing was packed away, But they had this, there's this big treasure trove of what they had. And, you know, for me and Tom, you know, it's UFO in Space 1999 and Thunderbirds. And then there's all the stuff before that. And to me, it's like they come up with these ideas and they're like, okay, we'll do this, we'll do this, we'll do this. And you got to realize it's a reflection of England during the 60s too, because Thunderbirds and Joe Nightingale, that's mod England. That's England, you know, going out of World War II into the, you know, the Beatlemania kind of stuff.
Definitely. And in a way, it's just kind of, you do get a lot of that just Britain has to guard itself, you know, when it doesn't fear international interference. And it's an interesting thing to have in a giant program, because, you know, you look at any other program, they don't really do that. You know, America, we don't really talk about guarding ourselves, because how dare we, you know. And
well, England's, England, it's kind of like isolationalist, you know, not the politics.
Yeah, not England, the politics England, by isolation, but yeah.
The, you know, England being an isolated country from the rest of Europe. And that's something you see with you know, with Space 1999, as I said before, is that isolation.
Totally.
You know, it's that theory of, you know, you're drifting through the universe on this planetoid, you know.
And you don't, and I'd have to delve into it a little bit further, but I want to say there, I saw a lot of parallels with that, with the individual characters of the Space 1999 in particular. Koenig was an American, or at least he presented American. He was a leader. He was the guy who had to make all the decisions. He had Dr. Bergman, who was more rational. He was very British. But you can kind of see the way Star Trek did visually, as far as showing people from all different cultures. But with Space 1999, they took it to another level by not just showing it,
but
kind of putting everybody in sort of a representative role.
Yeah.
Yes. That, you know, most people will just do it, hey, I have this superpower, I have this persona, but they're all kind of, you know, we're all part of the same oyster.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing too is that when you think about it, the show itself, it was not to be formal, because I think what they wanted to do was not show what Roddenberry did. Roddenberry made it still formal. Roddenberry made it formal. He didn't make it informal. This was a very informal show. You know, like you said, people called each other by their first name. People did this. People did that. Nope. You know, much. There was no, if you notice, nobody gets addressed by rank.
Right.
Nobody gets addressed by, you know, it's
everybody everybody had the variation of the same outfit.
Yeah.
At least until season two. But it was very much, it really helped to solidify the concept of family, because everybody was unified. Everybody had the same goal. Everybody was in the same predicament. So why not show that kind of unity, not just in the scripts or the acting, but in the visual element of it too.
They all feel like they belong together, as opposed to misfits who are here by, you know, job title, you know.
Yeah, and if you look at the background, a lot of it were done in whites and variations of whites.
Yeah.
So that create a nice sort of balance. And even you could tell the difference between the eagles, which were pretty much overlooked white, and their warships were called hawks. They were like,
I didn't realize that later they were, like they said, the eagles were armed, but we also have hawks. And I'm like, what the? I don't remember that.
Yeah, they showed up in a couple of episodes, I want to say in the first season, but they were just this sort of a reddish orange type of ship.
Yeah. They were in the one where the two kids get those two space kids get brought to the base. You remember that episode?
Yes.
The two space kids get brought to the base and they're like, our fleet is going to come here and destroy you. And Koenig's like, oh, really? That's what you think. And I think they tricked them.
Yeah.
they tricked them in some strange way to make them make it look like they destroyed everything.
Something like that.
I'm trying to remember that episode.
I will go through it all again. We will definitely do an episode.
But be prepared to pack a lunch, because not only are you going to have a good time with Space 1999, even with the second season, but it's going to inspire you to kind of want to look at other things that they've done. Series like The Secret Service. They had a couple of unsold pilots. And even you go back even further, you say, well, maybe I want to take a look at Thunderbirds again. And then I will say, well, what about Joe 90? What about Stingray? What about Supercar? What about this? And
get to what see about the Joe evolution. 90? What about the show that was kind of the takeoff on it, but they never called Space Patrol?
Yes.
Nobody's ever. I saw the pilot for that Space Patrol, and the guy who worked on it was. I'm trying to remember what it was, but he worked with Gerry Anderson. And yeah, he'd worked with Gerry Anderson, and trying to find it here. It was after Thunderbirds. Give me a minute here, because I'm trying to figure it out. Thunderbirds comes out, and they were originally called APF Productions, and it became Century 21 Productions.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus, Thunderbirds Ago flopped. I thought it would. Yeah, there's two movies: just Thunderbirds Ago and Thunderbirds Are Six. Thunderbirds Six. So, what was the one that they did? Yeah, there was Doppelganger. They did Doppelganger, which was Journey to the Far Side of the Sun with Roy Thinnes.
That's another shining example of just how they viewed science fiction. It's been done a million times before, but with Doppelganger, it really did kind of flip everything on its head at the same time. It followed TV the trope,
can go but, then and it, be on the big screen.
But then it flipped the trope.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to figure out the one where it was, they were saying it was, came out, I think, in 65. Maybe it was another thing, but they did the guy who, okay. So Anderson saw, okay. So attract imitators, notably Space Patrol, US title Planet Patrol, which used similar techniques and was made by several former employees and associates of Anderson, quote, including Arthur Provis and Roberta Lee. They had their own, Space Patrol. Yeah, that was like, hey, you know what, kids, we're gonna do something totally different, you know. They did have their little, you know, they had their little spinoffs and whatnot. But I remember Journey to Far Side of the Sun, because I actually had that on video cassette or something like that. And of course, Roy Thinnes, I know from Mystery Science Theater.
Operation Diamond Head, or Codename Diamond Head.
Yeah.
Lovejoy, as Lovejoy.
Hey, Lovejoy, how's it going?
Also starring a very young Eric Braeden.
Yeah, and what was it? Who was the guy from Hawaii 5-0?
Oh, Jack Lord.
No. The heavy set guy, Kono. Kono.
Kono.
Kono, the big heavy guy.
Yeah.
In the beginning. He was actually an ex-Marine in real life.
Oh, damn.
And you want to hear some shit?
Let's do it.
The reason he got fired, the reason Kono, whatever his name was, got fired off of Hawaii 5-0. Zulu, that's what it was. He played Zulu. It's like his name was Zulu, but he played Kino. I don't know. It's like one of those things. He got fired off of Hawaii 5-0. He had to go to a thing to be honored by the U.S. Marines, and Jack Lord wouldn't let him go.
That's fucked up. Oh, well, that's why Jack Lord's star never took off, and he stayed with TV. That's a shame. I didn't know that. But altogether, where would you just rank them as producers, since they were kind of just there and then kind of, you know, after the 70s died down, just kind of didn't do as much after that. And they had kind of an interesting reflection on experimentation TV.
They broke the ground for a lot of things with Super Marionation and with, you know, those up, and then with UFO and Space 1999, because they kept the episodic sci-fi show still alive.
Just in different forms. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, in different forms. But I think the thing is that I don't want to say the put into the whatever happened to kind of thing. The thing is, they're part of our childhood. And you don't want to regulate them to, like, you know, the cutout bin at the store with the crappy records. You don't want that to happen. So to me, personally, I think they made up a great, they were groundbreakers, you know.
They were the first, especially with marionettes. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll go even further. Whether it was marionettes or whether it was live action or even some of the later things they did with Space Precinct.
That was a good show.
They were able to combine the sense of wonder of a child with the sophistication and intellect of an adult and create just some great television. They had some hits, they had some misses, but overall they were doing things that other people would either imitate or use as inspiration or even without knowing it, their legacy will continue as long as you have people who are willing to take a look at a episode of The Protectors and really get into it like I did, or see an episode of Space 1999 and say, hey, that's kind of cool, or go back to Thunderbirds or anything like that and just feel that childhood magic. JJ mm-hmm. hit on the nose that these folks, they hit it. They knew their audience. And although they were primarily kind of relegated to the point of children's television producers, they ultimately proved well that their sphere went well beyond that into more adult-oriented programming that sadly gets overlooked.
Yeah.
Probably.
It was Tony Anhalt who was in the Protectors. It was Robert Vaughn, Myri Dawn Porter, and Tony Anhalt. And it's out on DVD.
Perfect.
I think it's also on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
I'm going to have Space Precinct, you mentioned that's on Roku too. So, yeah. There are options here, people. It is not just, you know, lost to the dawn of time. It's out there.
Yeah, it's out there. You just got to be willing to take a chance, watch it, and just see if, and just be blown away by how sophisticated it was.
Mm-hmm.
It still is.
Totally. And altogether, this has been a cool sit down because we're also just trying to just clarify just different kinds of imagination. You know, there's so many factors to weigh in, and often, you know, people get compromised by star power or budget or just network regulations. And these guys kind of were able to shift through the bullshit for the most part and just kind of just say, hey, this is what we want to do, and we can promise you ratings because, you know, we'll give you eye candy again, you know, for the less adventuresome viewers, and hard sci-fi for a crowd that's really into that, you know, if you stick mm-hmm. with it.
If you look beyond the nice shiny wrapping.
Yeah. And don't mind the puppet strings. Just look at what we actually got.
Well, you saw what I posted with Dudley Moore and Peter Cook did, right?
Yes.
They did a takeoff on Jerry and Sylvia Anderson's Thunder Stingray car.
They were trying to imitate the, you know, dubbing and
puppetry
walking.
Oh, and if you want to, I'll throw in one more last plug for the Protectors. If you want an earworm, Tony Christie's Avenues and Alleyways, the theme song for the Protectors. That'll get in your head and it will not leave.
We got to do an episode on that then.
That's the one thing I love seeing in the beginning of the Protectors. Robert Vaughn making eggs.
Yes.
Him getting up in his pajamas, putting his bathrobe on, getting the paper and making eggs. Wow.
Feeding the dog.
Yeah. And, you know, you used to be Napoleon Solo. Now you're a schmuck making eggs. But I can't say anything bad because, you know, he made his money. He probably made more money on that than I did in a lifetime, you know.
Yeah, I don't think anyone hates Robert Vaughn. For a guy who kind of just had like free TV hits and then from that point on did whatever he had, especially helping out buddy Roger Corman, I think.
Oh, yeah.
He's still pretty beloved in that he's just a likable guy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Funny guy, too, because I remember him being on the old Channel 9 Howard Stern show.
Oh, really?
With Howard Stern done up as Clarence Thomas, you know, very politically incorrect. And yes, he says, what are you going to do after the show? He says, what I'm going to do, I'm going to find my agent and I'm going to strangle him. You know,
oh, man.
It was just so funny to watch. But, you know, he had, what did he have? He had Man from U.N.C.L.E., The Protectors.
He had a brief recurring role in Law and Order, and then from that point on, he would do some voice and voice.
And he's in the A-Team. He was in the A-Team. Remember, he was in the last
season.
Last season.
Mm-hmm. Last season, yeah. I'll get you off, Hannibal. Jeez.
That's why they don't let Robert Vaughn on regular TV anymore.
He's. I met him in real life.
Oh, you did. Jealous.
I did. Jealous. I met him at Chiller, and I said, kind of be funny to be back here in Secaucus, huh? And he's like, what do you mean, young man? I said, well, you know, WWR is like just right down the road from here. And he just gave me this look of like, don't even bring it up. And I said to him, I know what you're going to say. I did watch that show and it was hilarious to watch. But I got to say, I told him, my favorite role he ever did was in Bullet.
Yes. That, Magnificent Seven.
Magnificent Seven, Bullet, Battle Beyond the Stars. You know, he was, but Pretty yeah,
Chang. I mean, I'm just kidding.
But I met Robert Vaughn in real life, man. He was a real cool cat, you know. Very, very learned man, too. He was a big fan of Bobby Kennedy. I think he was friends with Bobby Kennedy, too. I think he was there the night Bobby Kennedy was shot. Sure. I don't know. I don't look it up. Yeah, very, very diehard liberal Democrat, you know. So I think they were going to consider running for him for like Senate for Connecticut or something like that.
You really think he would have gone into politics?
Oh, I think he would have. He would have been great. You know, Napoleon Solo running for Senate. Jesus. In a heartbeat, man.
Yeah. Not to mention the voice, the gravitas in that voice.
Very you could say
the most insane
no
stuff and it would sound brilliant.
Mm-hmm. He did the Young Philadelphians,
yes,
with him and Paul Newman, where he played a guy I think accused of rape.
That sounds
and he was like right. He was like one of those breakout stars.
Yep,
from what I remember, because I remember him like, you know, he was like one of those guys. He was like one of those guys who's gonna be like, he'll be making waves, and then they gave him The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And he was just, you know, was off and running, you know.
Yeah, it was during that time where, you know, people were stuck up. They wanted to be one thing or the other.
But yeah. Yeah.
I recall him being in Julius Caesar with Charlton Heston, and that was
yes,
pretty cool.
Yeah.
And anybody,
Moorhan was put on celluloid that day.
Yeah. Moorhan was put on celluloid than you can put in a deli down in downtown Brooklyn.
there was so much ham it wasn't even considered kosher.
Oh.
It was so much ham, I didn't even want to go near it. That's how much ham was on the studio set that day. Friends, Romans, countrymen. Lend me your ears. I've not come here to bury Caesar, but to praise him. You demaniacs, you did it.
It may be a stinker, but I'll take it over the robe or even Cleopatra.
Or what was the one that the robe's pretty good. Cleopatra, what's the one, the silver chalice?
I think the silver chalice has some cheese, but I don't.
Silver chalice was the one that Paul Newman, when he did it, he actually put out an apology, like, "I'm sorry, I made this film. This was the first movie I ever made." And he's saying he would invite people over the house to just make fun of it. Yeah. Jack Palance is in it. He plays Simon the Magician.
Palance is in so many great. And by great, I mean wonderfully bad, wonderfully cheesy sword and sandals that are just dubbed. And you can just tell that he's half-assing it even with the dubbing. It's like, yes, I want you in my kingdom.
I just saw him in The Outlaw of Gore.
Oh, God. Yes. The original.
Oh, my God. Before
Gore 2, yeah.
Before, right, it's like, I think it's like maybe 2 or 3 years before City Slickers, he does this movie.
Yeah. And at the same time, it's Tango and Cash. Yeah.
And he's doing this movie, and supposedly the director of the first one left the film, so they brought the other guy in. And Jack was like, Palance was really good, showed up on set, but he didn't like the guy who was playing Carl Cap. Yeah, the main guy. I thought he was too big for. So there's a scene where he's like going to give him food. He takes the food, just smashes it right in the guy's face. I can't take it from him anymore. I crack bigger than him.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I can't say anything bad because, you know, Palance was just a bad. Palance is in. I think Palance is in two movies that they did. It's Outlaw of Gore and
The Hellcats.
Angel's Revenge,
yeah.
Yeah.
He was also in Hawk the Slayer.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Epic one of my movie. Favorite bad
80s still waiting on that sequel.
Sword and Sorcery movies.
Yeah. Where's that sequel? Need to make that sequel.
They should make a sequel with Hawk the Slayer. And I love watching.
I thought
that
they
movie.
Did fund it, and I have not heard anything since that crowdfunder happened. So.
And then they did a sequel to The Sword and the Sorcerer.
Yes.
With
yes.
Lee Horsley, which I loved because it was just, he was just like, yeah, I'm doing this movie. I don't care. You know, I'll just do it. You know, just give me a bunch of people.
This is the stuff I'm doing outside of Matt Houston.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna be doing Matt Houston soon, and I might as well just take it from here, you know. They couldn't get some, you know, hey, Conan's big, Beastmaster's big. I'll just do the movie, it's no big deal, you know. You got Simon McCorkindale, he's the cheese. I'm just gonna be the guy that just, you know, takes that triple sword out and just beats the crap out of people.
Oh man.
The Ginsu sword, it slices, it dices.
I mean, what else would you have a sword do?
But it's a triple sword. It's a triple sword.
And it fires harpoons and other shit.
And it fires, one part fires it. I mean, it's like, okay, yeah, we'll do that, yeah, no problem, yeah.
Well, this has been another epic sit down, and I think we just about got wiped out by just channel surfing through history.
Yeah.
But as you know, we're always busy buddies. I'm just feeling like we can really tackle the ups and downs of the 70s animated Lord of the Rings movies.
Oh, yes.
Next week.
Now, are we going to just do the Bakshi one?
We can focus on that mainly, since I think we can all argue that that's probably the biggest highlight, but we can talk about the other, was it Rankin Bass animated?
Yeah, because they did
TV movies.
I know they did The Hobbit and they did Return of the King.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to focus on those much because they're pretty singular. But
yeah, I just think the Bakshi one is something we can just dive into.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. We'll pretty much just go in chronological order and spend the most time on just the Bakshi, how ambitious it was. And even though it ends kind of, you know, abruptly, it's still very stunning, very epically voiced. And yeah,
I think we can. And one thing I will say about the Rankin Bass version, Return of the King. Not a single Elvis sighting.
What?
Not a single Elvis sighting, because get it, the king.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Hail to the king, baby.
The thing I love about the Rankin Bass one is, you know, the orcs and the trolls and everything, they look so much different. And it's like when they show the Rohirrim riding, they're all like on one road. It's like watching like the Salvation, like it's like watching like a bunch of cowboys come up the road, you know. It's like and the horn of Pelor, the King Theoden had come and he had brought the like
you know. Yeah, basically it.
And the thing I love the most about that is you have Theodore Bakel playing Aragorn in the Return of the King movie.
He was a great voice actor.
Oh yeah, yeah. I just saw him in 200 Motels with Frank Zappa. Oh yes,
sweet.
Anything, hey man, the guy. Hey, he worked with Zappa, man. That's all I'm gonna say. He worked with Zappa, man.
he worked with Zappa. I trapped it in Zappa, and I still do.
Oh man,
it wasn't very long. It was. I have Joe's Garage playing in my head.
Jeez,
we could jam in Joe's Garage. His mother would scream, "Turn it down." Joe got more involved in church activities, and his guidance counselor asked him if he wanted a donut.
It is what it is. It is what it is. Always a delight chatting with you all. It's always a party.
Same here. I had my fun tonight.
Oh, I hope so. We're not having fun, it's going to show.
Thank you for indulging me in this.
Pray moment of silence, because it was 42 years ago tonight. The 60s for me officially ended with the death of John Lennon.
Yep.
And that bastard Mark David Chapman shot him in the back.
Mm-hmm.
So, just to tell you guys, they are having the last Gilbert Gottfried Amazing Colossal podcast episode. Oh, wow. If you go to the Listener Society, I suggest you join it. You buy tickets for $15. You can watch it the first night, and then it will be on like for like 7 days or something like that. It's 2 hours. It's John Davidson, who I never realized was such a funny guy. Yeah. Frank Santopadre, Jason Alexander, Mario Cantone, Craig Burko. I'm trying to think who else was there that night. Rupert Holmes.
And it's everybody's paying tribute.
Yeah, it was a great thing they organized for Gilbert. His wife Dara was there, and Frank Santopadre did it. And I'm not promoting it. I just want to promote that because, you know, it's the last. It's like I hate to say it, but it's like this little cultural island is now getting walled up, you know, and maybe, just maybe, I might be doing a podcast myself.
Nice. Please.
I'm thinking about it. I don't know what it's going to be about. I'll have you guys on.
Okay.
We could just bullshit because I don't want to do anything political. I don't want to do anything. I just want to talk about funny stories. I just want to talk about growing up. You know, that's the thing. Growing up, that's the thing, man.
Sounds like a party. You know,
everybody had a different experience growing up.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
we just want to recapture that nostalgia.
Yeah, I just want to get that and be told, you know, just have it. So
let's nuke it.
Let's get it done, you know.
Let's get it on.
Let's get it on. Let's get it on.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up